Okay, welcome to this session of Marxism 2010. This is a session on how real was the threat of fascism in Australia during the 1930s, and we're very privileged to have Andrew Moore from the University of Western Sydney come to speak to us on that topic tonight. Andrew is the author of three books on the far right in Australia, so he obviously knows what he's talking about, and also a book on the politics of sport, which is one I will personally follow up. My name's Tess, sorry, I'll be chairing this session. So Andrew will speak for 30 minutes or so, and then there'll be time for questions and discussion.
Okay, thanks very much, Tess. I still find it vaguely hard to believe that you can actually hear me. Is it? This is indeed true. Oh, I need to stand up. Okay, yeah, that's probably a good idea. All right. So I was asked to speak about this issue of how real was the threat of fascism in the 1930s in Australia. And I thought I'd divide my remarks into three areas. First of all, I want to actually just sketch out some of the opinions that are around in prominent business circles, prominent security circles, prominent police circles, and prominent political circles about fascism. I also wanted to tell you something about an organisation called the New Guard, which I'm afraid I'm rather too familiar with, and I'm sure there's one of my ex-students here who feels the same way. They probably feel a bit tired of hearing about Richard New Guard yet again, but if I'm an expert on anything, I am an expert on this strange organisation called the New Guard. And interesting enough, I gather that recently there has been an attempt by the Campbell family, the family of the leader of the New Guard, Eric Campbell, to resurrect his political opinions. So there will be a diverse view coming out in that respect, another book coming out on Eric Campbell, which I'm quite pleased about, because I just sort of feel as though I have this field to myself and I don't know that I really deserve it all to myself. I think it's very rich. I sometimes think I probably shouldn't have spent the last 30 years on the far right in Australia, but then somehow or other those years went by and I did, so I can't really retract them now. Anyway, the first point about, I guess, is how extensive in prominent business circles, prominent political circles, prominent security and defence circles, and interest and sympathy for fascism is in the 1930s. It is very easy to find lots and lots of people who have positive things to say about Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, of course, from the 1920s and with Hitler into the 1930s. In fact, I'm haunted by an image of the New Guard leader and also an image of Adolf Hitler that appears in Labour Daily in 1933. And they were sort of interested in comparing. I mean, no one had any idea what was going to happen in Germany, of course, in 1933. They used to call the New Guard the Boo Guard, because when Labour people wanted to oppose the New Guard, what they would stand up and do is to shout Boo. And so they became known as the Boo Guard. And Adolf Hitler appears there in this sort of strange little caption that says, "The German Boo Guard leader, Adolf Hitler." And I thought, gosh, that if they had only known what was going to happen, you know, after the Enabling Act in Germany after 1933. Anyway, there's people like Sir Philip Goldfinch, who's the general manager of Australia's largest public company. He's also the leader of a secret force of special constables, which has the name of the Old Guard, not to be confused with the New Guard, but he is a big fan of dictatorship and writes this in his letters to friends in the early 1930s, goes to Germany in the mid-1930s, actually in the company of the former Prime Minister, Stanley Melvin Bruce, who he's a great mate of, and they both get pretty enthusiastic what they see in Germany. Businessmen like that are a dime a dozen. So Henry Braddon, former politician, the director of Dalgetty's, the big British pastoral company in Australia, he says the same things about what a great thing fascism is and how what we need in this country is a fascist and what we need is a Mussolini. And I guess that's pretty natural that you would expect people in big business to feel that way. But it's not just them, that's the point that I'm making. There are individuals like the politicians, like Menzies, who as Attorney General in the Conservative Lyons government in 1938 goes to visit Germany and is really impressed with the German people and with what he sees as the spiritual renaissance of Germans under Adolf Hitler. The Prime Minister, Joe Lyons, is so keen on, actually has a very interesting covert role in trying to promote Mussolini, but in Downing Street. You know, Downing Street in London's pretty sort of worried about Mussolini, but Joe Lyons, the Prime Minister of Australia in 1938, takes it upon himself to try and act as an emissary to smooth over the differences between Mussolini and Downing Street in 1938. So it's very easy to find this element of sympathy. And basically, of course, in the eyes of those sorts of people, what Hitler offered was an attempt to deal with an obstreperous labour movement, to put down communism, to defeat the Soviet Union, and that's really what they admired. That's really, what they really empathised with. And I guess, in a sense, the most alarming things are the people in the Defence Department, like the Chief of the General Staff in 1934, a guy who's usually not remembered, and odd to even refer to his name, you know, because no one would ever have heard of him, Major General J.H. Bruch, writes down that basically what's happening in Germany, that is, he's writing in 1934, so, you know, only about German history, there's some pretty horrible things that happened by 1934. What he's saying is that what we need to do in this country is to deal with the communists and to deal with the labour movement. What Hitler's done is put this on the agenda, and it's got to happen here sooner or later, so we might as well get on and do it. And that's the Chief of the General Staff. The New South Wales Commissioner of Police, one Bill Mackay, known a very Scottish gentleman, Wee Wally Mackay, he visits Germany also in the mid-1930s and is so impressed with Hitler Youth that what he does is he returns to New South Wales and decides to model the police boys movement, police club movement, on Hitler Youth, which is in fact really known about police movement in that respect. So, broadly speaking, there is a lot of sympathy for fascism. And I guess the general context of the way we study Australian history, I'm one of those people that sort of look at books, general narratives of Australian history, and you look under the 1930s and you usually find a paragraph, and the paragraph is about the New Guard, and the paragraph is usually to do with a guy called Frank de Groot. Now, Frank de Groot is an interesting character. He's remembered as a sort of harmless larrikin, but what he did was he intervened at the opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, slashed the opening ribbon. You might have seen the movie Tone News of saying, because there was actually a camera there to take a photograph of him. So it's well remembered, but what is usually not remembered is that he had a strong political component to his act. He was a member, he was basically Eric Campbell in the New Guard's number two at this stage, probably had aspirations of becoming number one. And he slashed the ribbon as an attempt to stop Jack Lang from opening the Sydney Harbour Bridge. In fact, it wasn't just an attempt. He did succeed. Sometimes said that Jack Lang opened the Sydney Harbour Bridge. He didn't. It was actually this guy on his horse using his cavalry sword from the First World War. And he basically said that they weren't going to allow... See, he said they were going to open the bridge in the name of the decent people of New South Wales, by which he meant people like himself and members of the New Guard. But it's because it was slightly comical, because it sort of somehow means that you can underplay fascism in the 1930s, because, okay, that's all it amounted to. And it is true, that was the major thing that New Guard did. And I'll just tell you a bit about the New Guard, but before I do that, I'll just mention that, in a way, the New Guard and the fascist element of the 1930s is really inconvenient if you believe in all of the dominant narratives about the 1930s, that is, we believe that in this country we are a democratic country. We believe that we believe in a fair go. And really the example of the New Guard doesn't quite fit into this. So I have this view that basically this is why not that many people still, to the present day, know that much about it. I mean, it is kind of like a hidden history, what I guess John Pilger calls a secret history, and that's quite seriously what I think it is to a certain extent. Not so much the New Guard, but other things to do with this type of movement. Let me tell you a little bit about the New Guard, because I think it does actually qualify. Gerard Henderson would disagree and has written this very much a couple of times, but anyway, that I'm an alienated leftist academic who believes in conspiracy theories and myths, but he believes that, the New Guard was not fascist and that there were no fascists in Australia in the 1930s. Well, the New Guard, I think, in all sorts of ways, very much exemplifies that. But let me tell you a bit about it. It basically has two periods of activity, in a way. The first period of activity is in 1931-1932, when it forms. It's a split from this other organisation, which I don't really have time to tell you about at this stage, the Old Guard. They set themselves up in business. They are a breakaway movement. They are very much reflective of some of the sentiments of the first AIF. They're strongly led by soldiers of the first AIF, not so much the rank and file, but the soldiers, the leaders tend to be people who are in the first AIF. Colonel Campbell, a Sydney solicitor, fits into that. So does Brigadier General Lloyd, who was his offsider, and so does Frank de Groot, who wasn't in the AIF. He was in the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force. But there's a strong element of returned soldiers in the leadership of the movement. They're very militant. They are stockpiling arms and ammunition. They are drilling. It's against the Crimes Act, actually, to drill. That doesn't stop them. They are bashing up workers regularly. From October, November 1931, they decided that they would take it upon themselves to go out to unemployed meetings, break them up, and call them communist meetings. They would break them up. And there are incidents like, and people know a bit about the Battle of Cable Street, but I always think the Battle of Bankstown, in all sorts of ways, is the forgotten, one of the battles of Bankstown is the forgotten era of Labour protest and right-wing protest, because in February 1932, there was a major battle in the southwestern suburb of Bankstown, which is where I happen to teach, that was about putting down Bankstown militants, really, and Bankstown unemployed one particular night. Members of the New Guard travelled there in their convoys of cars. You can see what the scene would have looked like. They all came across from the North Shore and the more comfortable suburbs and basically bashed up workers. So that's pretty serious, but I think the bit, and this is where I'd strongly have to disagree with Gerard Henderson about, and here I could become very boring because I know a fair bit about this, but the evidence that they actually planned to subvert democratically elected government, the form of the Lang government of this period, is quite incontrovertible. Let me explain a bit about what Jack Lang was. Jack Lang was the Premier of New South Wales. He's known as the Big Fella. He's actually Paul Keating's mentor, which is ironic anyway. He is probably the most loved politician of Australian history, but also the most hated. There is not, I mean, I think in Australia we tend to think we hate politicians, but I doubt that anyone has ever been as much hated as Jack Lang has. And set against the background of the Great Depression, when he's the Premier, he is responsible for trying to, quote, repudiate the debts, which he wasn't. He was talking about the interest payments, but that's the way the New Guard saw it. And a period of great economic crisis when it seemed as though capitalism could have gone under, because, I mean, there's none of the pump priming, none of the bailouts. Keynesian economics isn't around. They're just really mystified, actually, as to what to do. And what they did do, of course, was to pursue policies that would make the Depression worse. So Jack Lang really represents in all sorts of ways the absolute nemesis of what many people, decent people in the New Guard, regarded as what a politician should be. So they were determined to get rid of him. I think there's absolutely no evidence, no doubt from the archival evidence and from the oral evidence that that's what they intended to do. They intended to mount a coup d'etat against the New Guard. I mean, against Jack Lang. There are people who are then later on talking about how they were responsible for setting up machine gun nests in Macquarie Street, Sydney, where they were going to mount the machine guns towards Parliament House. There's just so much evidence that you really have to believe in amnesia, not to believe there is at least the attempt, the plan to stage a coup d'etat in 1932. So that's the first period of the New Guard activity. They go on after 1932 and become actually avowedly fascist, which is the time at which the leader of the New Guard goes to Germany, he goes to Italy. He's not a very good traveller, so he didn't really organise his dates around Hitler or Mussolini very well. Talked to the underlings, but they weren't around on the day he was in, either in Berlin or Rome. Got on very well, though, with Sir Oswald Mosley, the leader of the BUF, British Union of Fascists, in London, and basically planned, as he said, to become a lifelong friend of Mosley. So he really came back with his head full of enthusiasm for fascism. He says he's on fire for fascism, and he introduced various fascist regalia to all the meetings. He's accompanied all the time by a pair of bodyguards who clicked their heels in approved fascist fashion, and they introduced the salute. He'd actually done a fascist salute before he went away, but the fascist salute is the start of all meetings. They are dead set keen on fascism. The interesting thing about that is it went down like a lead balloon broadly, and a movement that probably at its peak had, say, 60,000 members, and that's a fair bit, I think you'd agree, in 1931, 32, say the end of 1931, maybe they had 60,000 blokes, I hasten to add, very, very small women's auxiliary, but blokes, it's about blokes and it's about masculinist activities too. So they collapse almost entirely. By 1935, they are dead and buried, and really I think it's partly because, that what Campbell did was to connect his movement with a sort of series of thing of images that looked as though they had nothing to do with Britishness. He might have been on stronger ground if he talked more about Mosley, but he talked a lot about Hitler, and indeed was probably very lucky, Campbell, that he didn't get interned in the Second World War. He should have been interned in the Second World War. By 1938, he's still talking about what a great idea Adolf Hitler is. He just changes his mind in 1939, and then, of course, all hell breaks loose in fascist circles, and plenty of fascists are interned, but he was never one of them, and I could talk about why that was so too, but I won't. So basically the New Guard, I think, is a very powerful indigenous movement of Anglo-Australian fascist sentiment. And it wasn't just sentiment, they were actually fed income. They actually meant to do something. I mean, Campbell is a bit of a... I think of him either as a goose-stepping megalomaniac who didn't really understand the forces that he had unleashed, or he is a straight out-and-out fascist. Maybe he's a little bit more of the former than the latter in 1931 and 1932. But he really looks as though he was just sort of making it up as he went along. But they're full of talk about how they are going to take on the blue coats and the red coats, and a few blue coats and a few red coats won't stop them. They are dead set serious about introducing what is essentially a fascist challenge to parliamentary democracy in Australia at that time. The final thing that I'll just conclude with is arguing about why perhaps fascism didn't succeed in the 1930s in Australia. I think, firstly, you can say that this is partly to do with events within the New Guard. That is to say, you could say things, for instance, like, well, Eric Campbell wasn't exactly a very charismatic talker or leader. He tended to put people to sleep rather than to charge them up. And indeed, he even the speech he gave that set Frank de Groot on his merry way in opening the Sydney Harbour Bridge was so convoluted. He actually said that what he didn't want was for Premier Lang to open the Sydney Harbour Bridge, but he managed to even say that in such a convoluted way. I don't really know that anyone could possibly have understood it. He was just a lawyer, I suppose, and he spoke like a lawyer with all of the complications and legal language. And I think that whole thing of the charismatic leader is really important in the 1930s. I don't know if any of you read a very interesting article by Tim Mason, who I think I attach a lot of weight to Tim Mason as a sort of socialist and Marxist critic of fascism. But one of the things that he said that Marxists have to come to terms with in terms of understanding fascism is the role of the personality, the role of the leader. And I tend to take Tim Mason fairly seriously, and I think he's right here, that Eric Campbell was a kind of dud leader. And one of the people that the Labour historian, very famous Labour historian by the name of Bob Gollan, went to hear Campbell and de Groot speak at Wollongong in 1931 and basically almost went to sleep rather than, you know, one thing or another. He was there as a Labour bloke wanting to work out what was going on, but even he thought they were too boring. It was no Nuremberg rally is what he concluded. So I think that that's the personality of the leader that's significant. And I often think, just in terms of that one little... I think I am a Marxist historian, but I don't attach that much role to the individual, perhaps. But, you know, it would be interesting to think what would happen if Sir John Monash had been more keen on fascism than he was. Because here you had, in Sir John Monash, a figure who was universally loved in the community, not just among ex-soldiers, highly respected. What he actually did was he was approached but to become leader of the New Guard and other things, and he said, look, how would you feel if you people who were approaching me this way, how would you feel if some communist came up to me and said this? I mean, would you not feel that that was treason? Would you not feel that this was, this is what he wrote to them in response, would you not feel that this was sedition? I can't possibly do this sort of thing. I mean, in a way that he, such an important, influential man, stayed away from Australian fascism and left it in the hands of the likes of Eric Campbell, might well say something about why it proved to be so unsuccessful. And I think that that's an influential factor. So things to do with the New Guard and its deficiencies, are really quite pivotal. I think if the New Guard had been more successful, it would have needed a more powerful leader. De Groot actually was a better speaker than Campbell, but being Irish, he told an awful lot of jokes. I think that people sort of thought that was more entertaining than Eric Campbell. But the leader thing is probably one of the issues, and I could talk about other things too. The other thing, though, I think, and in 1989, and this is a long time ago, but I was just thinking, I actually do agree with what I wrote in 1989, because I tend to think that it is important to see fascism as a stage of capitalism, and that it is a form of exceptional state that is sort of contingent upon what a national bourgeoisie wants to happen in terms of the democratic process and the future of the democratic process. Now, this is not to say a lot of... This is where I can be extremely boring, but I'll try not to be. Since 1989, there's been a lot of literature written on fascism and some great stuff, in particular by a guy called Roger Griffin, who has invented this theory that you need, in order to call something fascist, and he has introduced a whole discipline, which is now called fascist studies in England, fascist studies. what he actually talks about is if you can find palingenetic populist ultranationalism, then that is what a fascist movement consists of. Now, I won't go into that. But I think there's sort of been a lot of debate and counter-debate around the area. And the guy, and perhaps you might have read this, this book by Dave Renton, who's a trot writer, a really good trot writer in the UK, has written a book on fascism. And I think basically he makes a good case for maintaining an interest in the economic base of how do we interpret fascism. So basically I think that in essence what happened in Australia is that the crisis never got to the same point as it did in Germany. The labour movements are very assertive, the unemployed are occasionally very stroppy, the unemployed, I guess as we all know, did resist very strenuously. There was the Communist Party of Australia was pretty powerful. The left opposition, I don't know if you knew it, but in all sorts of ways there was a Trotskyist left opposition in Australia before there was one in Russia, which is really peculiar. The left opposition in Australia is pretty powerful. The Communist Party is pretty powerful. They have a group called the Workers' Defence Corps, which is a little bit inept. The police agent that is installed within the Workers' Defence Corps, because there are police agents everywhere, including within the New Guard, I hasten to add, reports that, he'd go to meetings and they'd all be busily talking about how they were going to leave and blow up Sir Thomas Horden's house or burn it down or kill policemen or whatever, but then they'd have another drink and somehow or other never went out that night. the Workers' Defence Corps is a significant organisation, but, in its own way, flawed. So I just think all of those sorts of things were such that the level of the crisis never really reached the stage that it did in Germany. And for those sorts of reasons, or in other places in Europe, and for those sorts of reasons, that is why fascism didn't occur. It's not to say there wasn't a great deal of sympathy, a lot of interest, and a lot of, fellow feeling for Hitler and Mussolini there was, but it was just that the crisis never reached the same level. The crisis of the Great Depression, as we're constantly told in terms of the GFC, is the greatest event, greatest disaster in modern economic history. And it clearly was, but in Australia it never really reached the same depth as it did in Europe. So I think that's really what saved Australia. It wasn't that there was no interest or sympathy for fascism. And I might leave it there. Thank you.